This is the takeaway for Friday, June 10th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. We thank you so much for listening. And on this Friday, just over a month from the Democratic and Republican presidential nominating conventions, is this the sound of the next vice president?
Donald Trump has run into a lot of legal trouble. Ah, yes, Trump University, which his own former employees refer to as one big fraudulent scheme.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren on the attack last night in Washington. Her name is buzzing around as a potential vice presidential pick for Secretary Hillary Clinton. Now, Warren is in her first term as a senator from Massachusetts, and she's earned political fame and fundraising fame on the left, the kind of fame and fundraising heft that only someone like, say, Bernie Sanders has been able to match. If Bernie Sanders supporters are turned off by Hillary Clinton, the thinking goes, Elizabeth Warren is just the person that might turn them right back on again.
We will not allow a small, insecure, thin-skinned, wannabe tyrant or his allies in the Senate to destroy the rule of law in the United States of America.
Now, one of the traditional roles of the vice president is attack dog in a campaign. Elizabeth Warren seems to be auditioning for that role and doing it quite effectively. But there are complications to the Elizabeth Warren fantasy pick for the left, however. A VP nomination would also put Warren's Senate seat in Massachusetts up for grabs. And Massachusetts has a Republican governor who could appoint a successor. Democrats risk losing that seat. And that makes people like Senator John Tester very scared. Tester is head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, in charge of strategizing, raising money, and spending money to help Democrats get the Senate back. And recently, I asked John Tester what he thought about Elizabeth Warren and another potential VP pick for Hillary Clinton, Sherrod Brown from Ohio.
I'm a big Sherrod Brown fan. I say it in somewhat jokingly way, but truth is, Sherrod and I are good friends, and it has a Republican governor in the state of Ohio, so it probably wouldn't be good for the body, but I think he'd bring a nice mix to the ticket.
And Warren?
Well, I don't know. Is the country ready for two women? I don't know.
And there is that question, is the country ready for two women at the top of the presidential ticket? Well, Harry Reid himself had something to say about that.
We've had two men representing the president and vice president for centuries. My personal feeling is I don't see why you couldn't have two women, whoever they might be. I think they'd be as good as two men.
Harry Reid himself has had a bit of a conversion on this. Just 2 weeks ago, to the prospect of Elizabeth Warren, Harry Reid was saying hell no. And now he appears to be saying heck yes. Now, while Hillary Clinton is not the first woman to run for president of the United States, she is now going to be the first to be nominated by a major party. Historic already, yes. But could she tap Elizabeth Warren to join her? Should she even do it? Monica Potts is a New America Fellow and formerly a reporter for the American Prospect magazine. She followed Elizabeth Warren closely before she was elected in 2012. And John Cassidy is with us. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Monica Potts, you know, VP buzz like this has a way of popping up not so spontaneously at times like this. What's going on here with this latest round of Elizabeth Warren VP media craze? Who's behind it and why do they want her?
Well, I know why progressives want her, and that's that what they saw in the Democratic nominating process was people who were really fired up about Bernie Sanders, and not just for his own sake, but for what he represented, which was this anti-Wall Street sort of critique of capitalism that took into account the middle class and the working class and what's been happening to them, and sort of, you know, juxtaposed them against the powers that be, which Hillary Clinton is seen to represent on the left. She, you know, the memory of Clinton centrism is really sharp in people's minds. And so they want to capture that energy, the anti-bank, anti-money, anti-system energy that they feel like Sanders has stirred up. And they think that Warren has the legitimacy to do that.
John Cassidy, has Elizabeth Warren been auditioning for it then?
It certainly sounds like it over the last few days. I mean, she gave a big speech in Washington on Thursday in which she says, I think you played some of it, you, Donald Trump, are a total disgrace. And then she was on MSNBC last night and called him a thin-skinned money grubber. So as you say, the role of the vice president is attack dog, she seems like she's perfectly suited to it. I think there are issues in picking Warren, one of which is that her and Clinton do have some differences going back on Wall Street. You know, back in 2001, there was a bankruptcy bill going through Congress, and Senator Clinton, as she then was, opposed the bill, having supported it when she was in the White House. Elizabeth Warren was furious about this and actually wrote several pages about it in her book. Senator Clinton's explanation was that she was only trying to protect women and children who weren't well treated in this bill, and she subsequently did vote against it in 2005. But I think there was a lot of bad blood there, and certainly Clinton and Warren weren't seen as allies. They were seen as representing different wings of the party until a couple of weeks ago.
So, Monica Potts, John Cassidy is describing not only different political philosophies and maybe differences between Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton, but a microcosm of maybe what Elizabeth Warren could do for Hillary Clinton. You mentioned that she is seen as the centrist, the operator, somebody who takes positions to benefit herself. I think my description of that perception is probably accurate. Elizabeth Warren is seen as somebody who's pure on the left and can cover her there.
That's right. You know, people hope that within a Clinton administration, Elizabeth Warren would be the voice for the people and the voice for commonsensical reforms that take into account what the middle class and working class need, and more progressive economic populism. Now, whether the administration is the place for her to do that is unclear. You know, she's a pretty powerful senator, even though she's only been there for a short amount of time. She has a public platform. She can criticize bankers within the Senate, and she can champion, you know, legislation within the Senate. And whether or not it passes, these are the kinds of things that will get the public's attention and will be passed around on Facebook and other social media. She's sort of a darling of, you know, the YouTube world, where people see her as, you know, the one politician that speaks to their needs and is the champion for them within that body. And that's more powerful than her one vote is in the Senate. And so whether the administration is a better place for her than that, I think, is a question.
Right. John Cassidy, the calculations, maybe we're going to try to get into Elizabeth Warren's mind for a second. Powerful senator criticizing from the outside, or team player, help Hillary Clinton get elected, have an influence from inside the administration, but that vice presidential influence, which is not necessarily as strong.
I think if you're Elizabeth Warren, you would want to do some bargaining before you accepted the role of vice president, because there are various types of vice president. I don't think she would just want to be a sort of fig leaf on the administration. I do think she'd want to have some serious influence on policy, particularly on Wall Street, where there have been some big differences between her and Hillary Clinton.
And John Cassidy, what did you make of that comment from John Tester, the senator from Montana, when I asked him about Elizabeth Warren, wondering aloud whether the country was ready for two women at the top of the ticket? You could argue that a candidacy like Donald Trump's, which Hillary Clinton is painting as anti-woman, might be very vulnerable to that type of image.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly ready for a two-women ticket. Whether the rest of the country is, I think, remains to be seen. I actually think it probably is. Certainly there'd be some sort of sexist Trump supporters who would never countenance this idea. But if you did have Clinton and Senator Warren at the top of the ticket, they're both very strong women, very impressive women, even if you don't agree with what they say. I think it'd be very hard to argue that they're not qualified to do the job and that they don't have the sort of constitution and character.
Monica Potts, it seems to me that white men who don't like Hillary Clinton already don't like her. She's not going to lose any more of them by drafting Elizabeth Warren.
That's right. But I think, you know, whether the country is ready for two women on a national ticket, that's the fear in the heart of every feminist I know, because we all thought that people would be ready for a female president and a Clinton candidacy. She was really popular before she started running for president again. And even though there are legitimate objections to Clinton, I think a lot of us see within the criticisms that she gets a sort of more subtle sexism, where maybe it's not, you know, men who say they would never vote for a woman outright, but sort of the ways in which they criticize Clinton and this sort of insistence on her ideological purity and her, you know, her being perfect, which of course no male presidential candidate would be, you know, perfect.
And yet, Monica Potts, on the left, you know, I can't count for you the number of Bernie Sanders supporters through my reporting or just hanging out who have come to me and moaned about Hillary Clinton. And if you mention Elizabeth Warren, their ears prick up and they go, oh, well, that would change things.
Well, that's easy to do when she's not running. I think, you know, when she's actually on the ticket, she's actually part of the partisan fray. You might see some things come out from that side that are not coming out now. You know, when you're part of the partisan fray and you're up for criticism, the ways that people think about you and talk about you change.
And John Cassidy, Elizabeth Warren, a nightmare of opposition research and criticism from the Trump campaign, or a dream to highlight the fact that Hillary Clinton already says he's anti-woman?
Well, I think the Trump campaign have already been attacking Elizabeth Warren on the issue of her Native American heritage. You know, Trump's been making derogatory comments, calling her the Indian and Pocahontas, etc. But Elizabeth Warren, whatever you think of her, you know, she's pretty tough. She's not been shying back. She'd been attacking Trump a long time before this on Twitter. I don't think that those sort of jibes are going to affect her very much. I do think there is an issue of whether the Bernie Sanders supporters, once she's seen as an ally of Hillary Clinton, will be so supportive. I've noticed on my own Twitter feed, for example, just in the last 24 hours, that quite a few Bernie Sanders supporters have been criticizing Senator Warren, which I've never seen before, and saying, why is she coming out so quickly for Hillary Clinton?
Well, the very moment that Hillary Clinton seemed to clinch the Democratic nomination, the buzz began, or rather was started, around Elizabeth Warren as a potential vice presidential pick for Hillary Rodham Clinton. Monica Potts, New America Fellow and former reporter for the American Prospect, and John Cassidy, staff writer for The New Yorker. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we'll bid farewell to the greatest, Muhammad Ali. But today, we learned of the passing of another sports great, Gordie Howe. Mr. Hockey has died at the age of 88. Here's Gordie Howe talking about growing up poor in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
There was a lady during Depression, couldn't get enough food for the family, and my mother dug into the old penny pot and gave her some money, and she returned with a bag full of things to give to my mother, and one of them was a pair of skates, and they dropped on the floor, and that was it. That was the seed. I put those things on. I never took them off.
Gordie Howe played a record 26 seasons with the Detroit Red Wings and then just kept on playing. He played professionally in some capacity in five different decades, spanning from the 1940s through the 90s and inspiring countless players. Here's NHL great Wayne Gretzky reminiscing about that famous photo he took with Gordie Howe as a kid.
Every time I look at the picture, I always think the same thoughts, that, you know, he was nicer and better and bigger when I met him than even what I thought he was going to be.
Gordie Howe won four Stanley Cups with Detroit, as well as six NHL MVPs. In 1990, Howe was honored at the All-Star Professional Sports Awards, along with Jim Brown, Rod Laver, and Muhammad Ali. Mr. Hockey, Gordie Howe, a Detroit icon, gone at age 88.
Back, the rival, it's knocked down by Del Vecchio, and Howe is in the right place at the right time to score Detroit's second goal.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Congress passed the Toxic Substance Control Act way back in 1976. It was designed to regulate the chemical industry and potentially dangerous substances that go into industrial processes, household items, even toys. But from the perspective of environmental and health groups, that law became all but toothless. The court said in 1991 that TSCA, as it's known in Washington, doesn't even apply to asbestos, a known cause of cancer. But now, 40 years later, Congress has agreed to some reform. The Senate passed an updated bill earlier this week. The House overwhelmingly passed it earlier this month. And now it heads to the president for his signature. Democratic California Senator Barbara Boxer negotiated the bill with Republicans. She says she held out for the best regulation she could get.
I used every prerogative that I had, every tool in my arsenal, to bring it down until it got better. And it is better. It is better than current law.
Better, says Barbara Boxer, but how good, really? The new bill allows for testing on the more than 64,000 chemicals currently unregulated by TSCA in everything from household cleaners to flame retardants in furniture. But is better than current law, as Senator Boxer said, good enough? Scott Faber is vice president of the Government Affairs for the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit environmental research organization. Scott Faber, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Well, under the updated bill that's going to become law, what gets tested now and what doesn't?
Well, Senator Boxer's right in that the bill will be better than current law, but that's not saying much since it's widely recognized as the worst environmental law in the books. What will happen, what's good about this bill, is EPA will now be able to order companies to provide basic data about chemicals, how toxic they are, what they're used in. And EPA will have to review new chemicals before they enter the marketplace. About 700 enter the marketplace every year. And EPA will have to slowly begin to review the backlog of old chemicals that have been on the marketplace for decades, some of which have been linked to cancer and other serious health problems.
And many of which have been grandfathered from the start. Even when the original TSCA passed 40 years ago, there were chemicals that were never tested that are in our homes every day.
That's right. And one of the reasons that groups like EWG and others don't support the bill is that the pace of reviewing those old grandfathered chemicals is really just too slow. You know, it's certainly fair to say this law is better than the law that was passed in 1976. But really, the right question we ought to be asking is this law, does it really reflect what consumers expect? And I think an ordinary person would say, gosh, all the dangerous chemicals, all the chemicals that have been linked to cancer and reproductive problems and neurological problems ought to be quickly reviewed and regulated or even banned if necessary. And unfortunately, this bill just won't meet that standard.
And so it's important to point out that even though this is better, they're still not testing chemicals like in the way the FDA tests a new drug, right? If you make a new drug for cancer or anything else, you have to do human trials, clinical trials before you can sell it. That's not happening here.
That's exactly right. And ultimately, the question of whether companies will even have to test chemicals and report that information to EPA depends on the EPA that's in charge. If there's a good EPA, an aggressive EPA that gets lots of money from Congress, then we might quickly get through the most dangerous chemicals in a generation. We might quickly review and regulate chemicals that have been linked to cancer in a few years. But if we get a bad EPA or Congress decides not to provide the money, well, you know, we might not make very much progress at all.
So politics and big deals like this are all about compromise, and that's not surprising. But when you look at the final product here, Scott Faber, is this really a new day in public health protection? You've already pointed out that it's not, but just in terms of the improvements, you know, frankly, a lot of people might worry when almost every member of Congress, along with a lot of health advocates, along with the chemical industry lobbyists, are all on board.
I think it's fair to say that this law gives TSCA, the worst environmental law in the books, a chance. But honestly, we won't know for about 5 years whether this law works. We won't know until Congress decides whether to provide the money that EPA needs to conduct all these chemical reviews. And we won't know until the first court reviews the first EPA decision. One of the reasons that we're even having this conversation is that in 1991, a court ruled that EPA didn't have the power to ban asbestos, something that's so dangerous it kills about 15,000 Americans a year, to even now. And it's not clear yet whether or not this bill untied the legal knots created by that 1991 court judgment. And so, honestly, we just won't know for at least 5 years whether or not this law meets the reasonable expectations of ordinary Americans.
Because you have to wait for the inevitable court challenges. Well, the Toxic Substance Control Act has passed Congress. It's headed to the president. The chemical industry gets rid of state regulations that give them a mosaic and a patchwork to deal with. They get to deal with one set of regulations. And the story is not yet written, says Scott Faber, about whether this new law truly protects consumers. Scott Faber is Vice President for Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, Mitt Romney and Donald Trump don't like each other too much these days, but what do those two guys have in common? They've both received cease and desist letters for using this song at their campaign rallies. Survivor sent a cease and desist letter to the Trump campaign last summer after he played that song at campaign rallies in 2012. Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich were also asked to stop using Eye of the Tiger. Well, coming up, we'll talk about the music the candidates play at campaign rallies and the trouble they get in if the artists don't agree with their politics. Hint, hint. Democrats don't get quite as many of these letters as Republicans do. And we've been asking you, what songs are on Donald Trump's playlist? What about Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders? From right here in New York City, Bernie probably enjoys that hip new sound of Elvis Presley. You know Hillary Clinton is a Joplin fan. And Trump, this listener says, probably listens to Wheels on the Bus.
The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round.
Hi, this is Damaris Morrill from St. Louis, and Donald Trump's song would be It's the End of the World as We Know It by R.E.M.
That's great, it starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane, Lenny Bruce is not afraid.
What's on your playlist? Call us, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always leave a comment at the website, thetakeaway.org. President Barack Obama was asked in April in a Fox News interview what he thought was the biggest mistake of his presidency.
Probably failing to plan for the day after what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya.
The day after in Libya. In 2011, European and American forces intervened in Libya on the side of rebels trying to oust longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. And ever since, it's been chaos. The world has watched as that oil-rich country divided along sectarian and tribal lines and literally divided the country into competing Eastern and Western governments. And now, Islamic State fighters have taken root in Libya in the coastal area around Benghazi. Some 6,000 ISIS fighters are estimated to have sprung up from existing factions inside Libya or arrived from the outside. A new offensive by the interim unity government is now trying to recapture territory lost to ISIS. This week, they claim to have captured the coastal city of Sirte, a key stronghold for ISIS in Libya. Vice reporter Simon Ostrovsky traveled to Libya this past February. He's the host of Libya on the Brink, airing on HBO today. Here's Simon speaking with Libyan Special Forces Commander Fadl Faraj Al-Hassi.
There's obviously still fighting going on here. We just heard a couple of shots. Do you need America's help?
No, thank you.
We just need weapons and ammunition. We have men here.
Simon Ostrovsky is in the studio with me now. Simon, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Let's go to Benghazi on the coast of Libya, a place that almost every American has heard about now. What is Benghazi like today?
Well, when we were there, the situation was very much in flux, and the forces of the Eastern government in Libya were on the offensive, and they were pushing ISIS and other affiliated groups like Ansar al-Sharia out of the center and out of the outskirts even of the city, and it was full-on war. The interesting thing is that the group Ansar al-Sharia was responsible for the killing of the U.S. ambassador there in 2012, and now we're 4 years down the line, and they're still active there. And those are the groups that then became affiliated with ISIS, and now the Libyan forces are having to deal with.
And is there a division now between Ansar al-Sharia and ISIS? Have they melded into one anti-government force?
They're pretty much allied, and now that they've been more or less pushed out of Benghazi, it looks like in the last few days there's been an offensive that's been started against the main ISIS stronghold in Sirte, but this time by the Eastern government. And that's interesting because the Eastern government, although not allied with ISIS, they are Islamist, sort of in the Muslim Brotherhood brand. They were pretty much for the last couple of years ignoring or not trying to engage in fighting with ISIS. And that's what we saw when we were there. So it's a big change to see them actually taking them on around Sirte.
Now, you spoke with General Khalifa Haftar. He's a general commander of the Eastern Army, the internationally recognized army that's doing a lot of the fighting. Give a listen.
For ISIS, Libya is a strategic location. That's why they want to gain control over it. If they do control it, Egypt will be in trouble. The East and West will be in trouble. They will be a threat to the rest of Africa. The door will be wide open. To who? To Europe.
Now, this is General Haftar making his case to governments in Europe and clearly to the United States for help.
On the one hand, on the other hand, everybody we spoke with in Libya from the East, from the Western part of the country, they wanted to take responsibility for what has happened in Libya themselves. What they are asking for is for the arms embargo in Libya to be lifted.
So let's talk about the ask that the general and other Libyan fighters are asking for. Are American and European diplomats buying that plea that if you lift the arms embargo, if you just give us the weapons, we can manage this? Is there a chance the arms embargo gets lifted? What's the calculus from the point of view of the Americans and even the Western Europeans?
I don't think the answer is to lift the arms embargo. I think the answer is for European and Americans to be much more engaged with politicians on both sides of the divide in Libya and to put a lot more pressure on them to form a genuine unity government. I just think that the Libyan agenda needs to be about more than Benghazi and about more than what happened there in 2012. It needs to be about what's happening in Libya today.
Simon Ostrovsky is a reporter for Vice. He's host of Libya on the Brink, airing on HBO Today, where they spent time in Libya on the front lines with fighters clashing with ISIS. Simon Ostrovsky, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You still don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
Oh, you just don't get it, do you?
Huh? You don't get it, do you?
Oh, you get it? I didn't get it. I got in early there on Friday movie day here on The Takeaway when we review the weekend's films with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
I know you get it. Now, this week we've got two films that we're going to talk about. Now You See Me 2 is out in theaters with Jesse Eisenberg and Mark Ruffalo. We're also going to talk about Maggie's Plan. But first, as per tradition, I have trivia for you. I'm going to ask you this question. Hold your answer, Rafer. We'll come back to it at the end. And by the way, out there, if you know the answer, you can tweet it at me, at Todd Zwillick, if you think you know the answer to this. We're going to be talking about Now You See Me 2. This is a film that centers around the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Let's take it back to the book of Revelation, chapter 6 in the Bible, if I dare. Name for me the four horsemen of the apocalypse. We've heard about these guys. Ooh. Do you know who they are? Don't answer now. We'll come back to it. But let's get on to the film Now You See Me 2. John M. Chu, Jesse Eisenberg stars along with Mark Ruffalo, Woody Harrelson, star-studded cast. Here's a clip.
Allow me to introduce myself.
Yeah, you're Walter Mabry. You died a year ago.
Yes, an idea I got from you, Mr. Wilder. I fake your death and the world puts its guard down. But you see, you all want an audience. I, on the other hand, want the opposite of that. I just want to be and I am 100% off the grid. You know why?
Yeah, because the grid is for actual human beings.
No, because in a world of total surveillance, the only true freedom lies in not being seen.
That sounds like Daniel Radcliffe of Harry Potter fame of old.
That is indeed. He's playing an evil Steve Jobs type who's got this computer chip that is going to be an all-surveilling, market-rigging disaster for the world. Of course, he wants to be off the grid, and the four horsemen are going to have to pull their usual tricks and sort of steal this chip away from him. The first film had its moments. It was kind of fun, a flashy action thriller. It was a little stupid, but I kind of enjoyed it. And I feel like this film is a lot stupid. And I think the problem is, they keep doing these ridiculously impossible sort of, David Copperfield times 10 stunts. But when they explain it to you kind of, Penn and Teller style, the explanations are just as outlandish as the magic. You never feel like you've really been led into some kind of a secret. And so I just feel like this is one of these films that's just overly flashy and gets a little carried away with itself.
And no great reveal there. Let's move on to Maggie's Plan. Now, this is director Rebecca Miller.
It's so funny. You know John Harding.
Oh, we're on a committee together. He's a real panty melter.
Why?
Why?
Oh, nothing. We had a mix-up with our checks because of our names, Harden, Harding.
Right. He's one of the bad boys of fictocritical anthropology. Apparently he was a big deal in Chicago. And now he just does adjunct work here, but they're really salivating for him to work full time.
We've got Greta Gerwig, we've got Maya Rudolph. I love Julianne Moore.
Yes, she plays the husband of John Harding, who is the fictocritical anthropologist played by Ethan Hawke. This is a rom-com. Greta Gerwig plays a woman who's getting herself artificially inseminated, but then she falls in love with Harding, a married man. You kind of think this sounds like a typical romantic comedy, but the director, writer, Rebecca Miller, is the daughter of Arthur Miller, and she throws in a lot of really great complications, funny twists. It's very New York-y, very funny, but also very real. And I just loved this movie, and I love Greta Gerwig in this film as well. well.
So there's a recommendation for Maggie's Plane. That's good to have when you can recommend for the weekend. That's
exactly.
Great. All right. Well, at the top, Rafer, since we were dealing with the Four Horsemen, I asked you to go back to the Book of Revelation, chapter 6, in the Bible, in the New Testament, and name for me the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. A bunch of people on Twitter know this one, by the way. Rafer.
Are we talking about things like famine, pestilence, death,
yeah.
Drought?
Oh, you were so close. Oh. 3 out of 4 is meritorious. Famine, pestilence, death, and war.
War.
War. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. 3 out of 4 on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse on the Revelation. Not too bad.
I just didn't get it, did I?
Most of the way. Well, if you've been watching this season of Veep on HBO, you know that Jonah Ryan is running for Congress in New Hampshire. And Jonah Ryan's campaign slogan is that he won't back down.
Ooh, we just got an endorsement from the Courier.
And the emails from Tom Petty's lawyers keep on getting angrier and angrier.
How am I not on the Hill's 50 hottest staffers list this year?
Now, there's one amazing detail of the political campaign that Veep got right there. It's the cease and desist letter from artists who don't want campaigns they don't like using their music. And if you go down the recent list of presidential campaigns, it runs like a list of cease and desist letters. Bruce Springsteen objected to Ronald Reagan's use of the song Born in the USA in 1984. Reagan also got dinged by John Cougar Mellencamp for Pink Houses. There's a whole long list of these. Melissa Locker is here with me. She's culture reporter, writes for The Guardian and Time Magazine, among others. She does Culture with Us on Fridays. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Todd.
I just started the long list of presidential rock and roll cease and desist letters from starting with Ronald Reagan in 1984, but there are a lot of other ones.
There are so many because it seems that Republicans in particular tend to be on the wrong side of the political spectrum for the musicians who write the songs. So you have Bobby McFerrin telling George H.W. Bush to go ahead and worry because he doesn't want them using Don't Worry, Be Happy. And you have people like Survivor objecting to Mitt Romney using Eye of the Tiger.
And that's such a fight song. Survivor had to come back this year and write a very nasty public letter to Donald Trump to say, don't use Eye of the Tiger.
Right. And at some point, Republicans are going to realize that as much as they want to be the Rocky Balboa, Survivor is not going to let them use Eye of the Tiger at their rallies.
It's not just Republicans, though. Barack Obama got one in 08, right?
Yeah, and Sam and Dave objected to him using Hold On, I'm Coming, which is not a song I particularly remember, but I guess they didn't want anyone else remembering it either.
So what is it about rock and roll and these artists, do you think? I mean, you get paid either way. Somebody's going to buy the rights. So why do these rock and rollers want to go out publicly and tell a politician, Republican or Democrat, don't use my music. I don't like what you're doing.
I really think it's the idea that they are implicitly advocating for that candidate, that they're saying, hey, yes, please, I'm Neil Young and I want Donald Trump to sing Rockin' in the Free World at every single one of his rallies. When in truth, Neil Young is kind of on the opposite side of the spectrum, and when Bernie Sanders uses his music, he doesn't have a problem with it.
Okay, so the cease and desist letter, the angry rock and roller and the staid politician, is one part of the backdrop of political culture here. But on the positive side, campaigns are putting more and more effort into choosing what kind of music not only they play at rallies, but how they kind of want to use it to form their brands.
Yeah, exactly. So if you go to any of these political rallies, like Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, they're going to have a bigger group of musicians to choose from. So you can get these incredible playlists of stuff that you would actually hear at, you know, anywhere from your junior high school prom to college music charts. What's wrong with being confident? What's wrong with being Clinton is playing Demi Lovato. Wake up, everybody. She's playing John Legend, Wake Up Everybody, and she's also trying to find, like, a very diverse demographic. So she'll have everyone from John Legend to, like, Juanes to Jennifer Lopez, just making sure she appeals to absolutely everybody with her music.
So then in that way, that makes music just like any other political tool, like, oh, look at our music choices. They are carefully handpicked.
Absolutely. And I think it also kind of works in the way of a political dog whistle, where if you're standing at a Bernie Sanders rally and you start hearing the word revolution in every single song, that's going to kind of earworm its way into your brain. Yeah, the revolution starts now. Oh, hey, I'm at a revolution.
Well, here's an earworm for you. Bernie Sanders has played this at rallies.
Efficiency in progress is ours once more. Now that we have the new Tehran bomb, it's nice.
Now, that's some punk rock stuff from the Dead Kennedys. A very sarcastic, tongue-in-cheek, and biting satire, Kill the Poor.
Right, and I think Bernie Sanders realized that he was appealing to millennials, and so they started to skew their music a little younger and younger and younger, and so you're getting things like the Dead Kennedys, which, you know, are probably more of like a middle-aged demographic at this point, no offense, but they're just willing to take more risks.
What has Donald Trump been using?
Donald Trump is very, very interested in the music that is played at his rallies, and he's been actually, as far as I understand, he has been handpicking and curating the playlists. The Washington Post went to one of his rallies, and they described his music as authoritarian hold music, because it's things like Billy Joel and, very strangely, Elton John, making the music so bland and so sort of insipid that you don't really notice it's there. I just think these are his personal tastes. These are the bands that he loves, and if he could, it's probably what's on his iPod right now.
Well, I'm sure we'll get to the point in this campaign where staffers are pushing out to the press the eclectic and cool playlists that their bosses use. Until we get to that point, we have the rally music and the cease and desist, which is the most important part to me. Melissa Locker, culture reporter and our Friday culture guide. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
This is Jack from Council Bluffs, Iowa. The songs I'd pick for Donald, it would be I Did It My Way, because he's all about him.
The record shows I took the blows and did it my way.
And for Hillary, it would be These Boots Are Made for Walking, because it's all about her.
One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
And for Bernie, it would be Why Can't We Be Friends, because it's all about us.
This is Kate, and I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon. I heard We Are the Champions playing behind Trump's speech last Tuesday after the primaries.
I've had my shells and kicks in my face, but I've come through.
I need to go home.
I'm sure Freddie Mercury was rolling over in his grave.
We'll keep on fighting till the end. We are the champions.
And C. Augusto tweeted us, the best Feel the Burn song is Talking About Revolution by Tracy Chapman.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation.
We've compiled a playlist with all the songs the candidates are using out on the campaign trail. You can find it at thetakeaway.org. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can always comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to advance cutting-edge research and cures and committed to helping to make someday today for thousands of blood cancer patients. Learn more at lls.org.
The greatest of all time will be laid to rest today. After a week of tributes and remembrances, there's a funeral service for Muhammad Ali in Kentucky. Yesterday, an estimated 14,000 people gathered to mourn him at a janaza or a Muslim funeral.
أَلَمْ تَرَ كَيْفَ فَعَلَ رَبُّكَ بِعَادٍ.
And I'll be officiating the janazah for our dear beloved brother Muhammad Ali, the people's champ.
Now today, thousands more celebrate the People's Champ at an interfaith service in his hometown of Louisville in Kentucky. President Bill Clinton is to deliver the eulogy for Ali. The Obamas sent their regrets. Today is Malia Obama's high school graduation. But it's the perfect day to have Rosie Perez here. Our Takeaway studios, of course, are here in New York, where Ali fought 11 times during his professional career. Rosie Perez is an actress and an activist. She got her film debut dancing a lot like Ali, as a matter of fact, in white trunks with black trim, dancing like Ali in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. And around New York, you'll catch Rosie Perez ringside at nearly any fight, from the Barclays Center in Brooklyn to the small clubs around the city. It's where Rosie Perez has earned her title as the First Lady of Boxing, a fan, a devotee, and an expert in the fight game. Rosie Perez, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And I'm happy to have you. What have you been thinking about this week?
Oh, so many thoughts have flooded my mind. The great author who spent a lot of time with Muhammad Ali, Thomas Hauser, emailed me to check on me to see how I was doing. And I told him, I said, I can't stop crying. I feel like a family member of mine have passed away. And he said, don't cry, smile and remember him, because that's what he would want you have. He would have wanted you to have done.
Do you approach Ali as an activist, as a leader, as a fighter? You're probably going to say all three, but where do you start with him?
I start with Ali, despite the fact that I've been named the First Lady of Boxing. I would start with Ali as a human activist, because there has never been anyone in the entertainment industry or in the sports world that really put his career on hold for his principles, whether you agreed with them or not. You know, he did that, and he lost 3 to 4 years of his athletic career because he did not want to fight in the Vietnam War. And that's really outstanding. So for me, he's a human activist first and a fighter second.
Muhammad Ali refused to step forward for the draft in 1966. He lost his boxing license.
That's right.
He faced prison time. He went to the Supreme Court.
My intention is to box to win a clean fight. But in war, the intention is to kill, 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 and continue killing innocent people.
I always came at Ali for his political activity, for an athlete and a celebrity. Not like, look, Bono is great, George Clooney is great. I like those guys too. But this is somebody who laid it on the line. He put his entire career out there, lost millions of dollars of income, and could have gone to jail for refusing to step forward. I've heard him referred to this week by some as a draft dodger. He was the opposite of a draft dodger.
Yes, I would agree. And you know, and I get into a lot of debates with boxing fans who have served in our U.S. military, and they have very, very derogatory comments in regards to Ali. And I said, how can you say that? How can you say that? Whether you agree with his stance or not, you have to give the man credit. You know, you talk about George Clooney, you talk about Bono. Would any of them today put their career aside for their principles, for their beliefs? You know, maybe so. I don't know. And so, you know, in regards to a boxer, you know, he was the greatest. He was the greatest, because even Mike Tyson stated that Sugar Ray Robinson is viewed as the greatest, but still, Ali was faster than him, and that was extraordinary for a heavyweight. And so he was an extraordinary fighter and an extraordinary human being. And the one thing that I want people to really understand about Ali that I personally took from him is that he was the first person of color to stand up during a very, very tumultuous time in our country and say, I am who I am. Get used to it. I am confident. I am cocky. This is my God, not yours. This is my belief, not yours. I am here. Get used to it. And that was really an extraordinary thing to say. And in the same breath, he was the same person who said disparaging comments about Frazier. I mean, horrible comments about Frazier. You know, during that time, it made America, the people of color in America, really, really think about their politics and really think about which side did they fall upon. Were they the new angry black man of America who said, I am not going to stand for the white establishment? Or were they on the side of Joe Frazier, who says, I love America. I'm not an Uncle Tom. There's nothing wrong with my belief system. He's just an incredible man. And later on in his career, he stood up and apologized to Joe Frazier. The apology came late, yes, but he did apologize. In regards to Malcolm X, he apologized. He says his biggest mistake ever was turning his back on Malcolm X. Who does that? Who stands up and says, I made a mistake and I ask for your forgiveness?
And in politics, in the part of Ali's life that was political, almost nobody does that. I want to take the minute that I have with you, Rosie Perez, and I want to talk about boxing because you have expertise in this about his speed, not only his fists, but in his feet. And I want to talk to you about fighting. How do you view Ali as a fighter? He was fast, as you said. Now, I've already said in the beginning of Do the Right Thing, one of the things that you're famous for, I saw it was hip hop, but I saw those feet moving. And I saw those white trunks with the black trim. A little bit of Ali there.
A tad. I won't claim that because that would be an embarrassment. I would say this is that he was extraordinary because not only was he extraordinary with the jab, he could throw the jab in such rapid fire succession for a heavyweight. His weight was not a factor. And also his right. He used his right in a devastating way. And his feet, the Ali shuffle that he coined himself. He could walk backwards, throw a punch, and slip out of the way. And he would force his opponent to charge towards him, and then he would tag him again. That's extraordinary. If you understand fighting, that's extraordinary. Because the basis of the sweet science is to hit and not get hit. And in his early career, Ali mastered that. He mastered that, hands down. And it was sad that the time that he took off, he came back and he was a little bit slower. And still, he found a way to win.
And I would encourage people to go back. There's a fight that nobody has seen against Jack London during the time that Ali lost his license and was fighting in Europe. He went at a guy named Jack London and hit him with about 13 punches in 3 seconds. The last one on the top of London's head, and he dropped him.
Oh, I'm impressed.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
You go back and watch the fight and you'll see the speed. Now, Ali was accused, of course, of running from punches, but he had those fast feet. But when he came in with those fists, and you can see it in the Jack London fight, Rosie Perez, it was like a machine gun.
You know what? If you understand boxing, he wasn't running from punches. That's called dancing. That's called the Willie Pep.
And that's where we'll leave it. That's the dancing, and nobody knows dancing and boxing better than Rosie Perez. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The world bids farewell to Muhammad Ali, protester, leader, risk-taker, showman, heavyweight champion of the world, and in his words, the prettiest fighter ever to step foot in the ring. And one final takeaway for you, the Tony Awards are on Sunday. Hamilton is favored to win Best New Musical and everything else, but did you know that Muhammad Ali starred on Broadway? He played a militant black lecturer in the musical Buck White while he was barred from boxing back in 1969.
We came in chains. We came in misery. Now all our suffering and pains are part of history.
Muhammad Ali is Buck White on Broadway in 1969. You can always follow me on Twitter at Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I am Todd Zwillick, and for John Hockenberry, this is The Takeaway.
We came in chains.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, whose goal is a world without blood cancers, funding research for new treatments and targeted approaches to therapy. Learn more at lls.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.